Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Judea to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome to the house of Rona.
Yes.
The house of Rona.
First, we have a house guest.
That's right. We have a house guest. Her name is Rona. That's short for Corona. And that voice that you hear is not the voice of Rona, although Rona is with us.
Is with us always.
Yes, right. And that voice that you hear is Malka Fleischer. Malka, shalom.
Yes, I got the Rona.
You got the Roned.
I got Roned.
You got Roned.
I know. But I'm okay. We're okay.
Yeah, we're all right. Okay. We're all right. Yeah. We're
like us and everybody else, basically.
What?
Like, it's like a de facto shutdown here in Israel because so many people have Corona.
Right. I don't know where you are out there in the world, but here in Israel, it's like, it's
lost a lot of the fear factor because
like everyone has it.
Yeah. And vaccinated and not vaccinated. Basically, now that it's hitting the vaccinated people, everyone has actually calmed down significantly.
Right.
Because you're just like, okay, we can't do anything. Like, we're just everybody for themselves. Good luck. Like, it's going to be fine. And really, Baruch Hashem, mostly it is fine.
It's mostly fine.
Mostly people are fine.
I want to say that you and I, after these 2 years, finally got Corona.
Yeah, we finally got it. I mean, we didn't get the Delta, it seems like.
No, we didn't get the Alpha, Omicron. The Delta.
Omega.
We got
the Omicron. We don't know. They don't tell you, but
yeah,
I think
it's we got some kind of light version of it, Omicron most likely. I wasn't surprised to get it. I was fine with it because I knew everybody around me had it. It was just a matter of time, and I wasn't trying not to get it. Frankly, not trying too hard. I wasn't trying to get it, but we do have friends who tried to get it and indeed got it. But it came. It was a weird week. We were weak
again. We're in Bidud, right? So that's part of it. And then it was rainy also and like grayish outside.
That's right.
We do have some symptoms. Like I had some, the first day that I had Corona, I was like in bed all day. I got the crawly skin and the like flu-y feeling, you know?
Right.
I slept a lot also. It was Shabbat.
Right.
And my Shabbos nap was like 3 hours, something crazy for me.
Right.
And then when I got up, I like didn't even feel good still. I think one of our kids brought it in the house. We had a kid whose friends were sick. And all
everybody
that.
At my work had it one way
everyone
or another.
Had it.
Everybody
so,
had it. All
so then we didn't feel good. I feel pretty good, thank God. Like I had a little bit of a cough. I'm talking about like like that. Like nothing like, not like a, not like a, you know, no hospitalization, Baruch Hashem, right. Not even close. It's a kind of sickness that had I had it 3 years ago, I wouldn't have even called the doctor for. Like, I would have been like, oh,
right.
Look at that.
Work day.
I don't feel good. Yeah. All right.
That's right. No big deal.
We do have some interesting stuff. Like, I got today a little bit of lower back pain.
Right.
And we both of us, it could also just also be very much a contribution of the weather, but we have like,
splotchy
not weird vision,
vision
but kind of like funny perception of light and darkness a little bit.
Yeah.
And like yesterday I had a little bit of like eye soreness.
Yep.
Sort of like I, you know, played my Atari for
nothing
like
has tasted
12 hours.
Good to me, and I taste everything just normally.
Except
it just doesn't taste good.
No, there's one thing.
A little bit of strawberry ice cream was the only thing, and I've been like off of sugar, so it's been the only thing. Just now, also,
yeah.
I just had a cup of coffee, and I'm like, I need that mechupela chocolate.
You needed a chocolate, did that taste good?
Yes.
So thank God.
Thank God.
There's still some things out there, Baruch Hashem.
Things packed with sugar are still,
somehow miraculously still delicious.
But even in the stomach, nothing like feels
nothing's
good.
Nothing's digesting well.
No. Nothing,
I'm not having digestion problems.
Nothing. It's not like sitting yummy. It's like all sitting icky inside. Anyway, so that's Rona. So Rona is a house guest right now. And I hope that next week we'll be done with Rona.
We did have some friends who brought us ice cream.
Yes.
That was nice. We also have Krista who bought us 26 cups of coffee.
Ooh.
So we're feeling really wired.
Thank you, Krista.
We really want to thank her.
God bless her very much. She's the greatest.
She's the best.
Krista went to buymeacoffee.com/Yishai and bought me something.
Okay.
It's not real coffee, but it feels like it
goes into the blood like coffee.
If you don't understand what that means, it's just a way to support the show and to show your love. And it's just a great, it's a gimmicky way of saying like you would buy me a cup of coffee if you saw me in the street, right? And so it's a great way to share the love and to support and to be partners with the show. So Krista just bought 26, is that right?
Yeah, that's a lot of coffee.
That's a lot of coffee. So thank you very much, Yishai.
We're gonna enjoy that. That's like 13 days of you and me sitting down for a cup of coffee.
Yeah. So that's
well. It looks like soon we are going to go sit out to have a cup of coffee because we'll have our Tavia Roque, which means our green passport. Except it looks like the green passport thing is being phased out. And while I want to say, and green passport, by the way, for those of you who just woke up, it's 2022. Good morning. Okay, just woke up in 2022. The green passport in Israel is a system by which they decided that the vaccinated people and the recovered people can be authorized to like go live their fullest life, whereas the other people cannot necessarily do that. And by the way, vaccinated for our purposes does not mean having one or two vaccines. It means having three vaccines or having your last vaccine within some certain amount of time. So we did not fall into that category, which means that we have not had the green passport for some time. That's okay. It really hasn't been super prohibitive. But now we're going to have a green passport. But now they're phasing out the green passport.
Good. Good. Green passport.
And I'm like, I'm only mildly resentful because I wanted to be, you know, top tier citizen for a few minutes also.
We listen, let's just be so thankful, you know, and even the bedewed time. The quarantine time has been tough, but not horrible. Last night played there was a little bit of very light snow, a dusting, and yet the kids and I went out, and I was on a call, and I still managed to go outside and throw snowballs at the kids, and they throw snowballs at me, and we're doing our best out here.
And that was after you had a big debate last night on Sulha.
Yes, I debated Amir Zahir. Why do I call him that? Because
I don't know. You keep calling him. I had to pass you a note in the middle of your debate to stop calling him.
Do you know why?
Amir Zahir and just start calling him Amir.
Do you know why? Because there's a video where he goes, Israelis, they could never say my name, Amir Zahir. They can't pronounce it. It's too hard for them, something like that. And he's making fun of us. Okay. Any case, this guy.
He's a comedian. He's a law professor. And he is a seriously, seriously anti-Israel, pro-Palestine movement guy who you basically got to admit during the debate, and you can see it on YouTube. Look up Sulha, Sulha.
Yeah, you can do that, or just
type in Yishai Fleisher, like the latest thing.
It'll be in my email now.
It's gonna be
on the YishaiFleisher.com, the link to
right,
it.
So it'll be all over the place. But basically, you got him to say out loud during the debate that he is calling for the end of Zionism and believes that a Jewish state is a supremacist country and it should not exist.
Right. Right, yeah, he was totally an anti.
Like with all his like, ha ha ha, I'm a comedian, I'm so hilarious. Like, he is a major serious terror supporter and is not funny at all.
Yeah, he literally serenaded, by his words, a woman who killed two Jews and who's hiding out in Jordan now, just a terrorist, and has said he calls Zionists dogs and bastards, and he says that every element of Zionism is racism, like, and then he comes on the show and puts out this like liberal face. What I want is a secular democratic state for all peoples, and yes, the Jews are also indigenous, la 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 la. And that's, and my whole point was, now some people can watch that debate and say, Yishai, you were just a tad aggressive and a tad personal with him, which is true. I was a tad aggressive and a tad personal with him, but my point was, and I think the point was made, which is this guy is not what he seems to be, and that we're in the midst of a narrative war.
Right. He's trying to put on like a kumbaya, like let's here have like a dispassionate discussion thing. In the meantime, he is endangering the lives of Jews.
You know, Malka, I figured out that the anti-Israel movement has a spokesman and a language for every level. For every like tahana, every station of a kind of way of thinking, they have somebody to speak and to speak to you at that level. So if you're at the level of like that, you're like, you believe in liberal democratic rights, they've got a guy for you who'll speak it that way. If you're more like a jihadi version of a Ku Klux Klan guy, they have that that guy for you. If you're more of a what other kinds are there? If you're like a BDS guy, they'll have BDS for you. If you believe that it's only about like Judea and Samaria, and that the Palestinians only want Judea and Samaria, they got a guy for you. If you believe that, like as I said, BDS, like that kind of tactical work, they have that. They have a flavor of somebody.
Spokesperson.
A spokesperson and a messaging that's just right for your place with all the same goal, which is to unhinge you from your pro-Israel stance. Some way to make you less sure, less supportive of Israel. And it's quite sophisticated. It's like, let's say you're an Al Jazeera type watcher, they'll give you the full on Israel's an occupation, blah, blah, blah. But if you're like a Jewish person, like he didn't say, you know, although on his Twitter, he said that every aspect of Israel is illegitimate and that we have no indigenous rights and we're the colonialists. For us, he literally said, no, Jews are indigenous. How could I deny that? I can't deny that. It's just that now we need a secular democratic country that will work for everybody. It reminded me about how the UN used to talk about Jerusalem. Like, how do you get the Jews to relinquish Jerusalem? You can't, right? It's like the heart of our history. So what did they come up with? Let's internationalize the city. You see, you're going to have it. We're not going to take it away from you. It's just going to be internationalized. Isn't that nice? The word international is nice for Jews. Jews like that word. Everybody's together in it, right? That's a way of internationalizing Jerusalem is a perfect language for a certain kind of Jew. You know, the Jews that fall for UNism, you know what I mean? Who are like, well, there's the international law and the international community, and then there's the UN, it's the international body. And so that kind of like, for those Jews, like a Jew like me, you tell me the UN said
it means nothing.
Yeah, I might as well be, throwing bottle caps at rings at bottles in Great Adventure. You know what I mean? It's like it means nothing to me. It's like what is it? It's nothing to me.
What an interesting metaphor.
Yeah, you know the ring toss.
Yeah,
it's like cling. That's what it's worth to me. It's like clung, clung, clung. It's like nothing. But for some people, like whoa, the UN said, wow. You know, the ICJ said, or something like that. So they have a station manager for every kind of person. You know, for example, archaeology. We keep on unearthing deep archaeology from Jerusalem and these places showing Jewish connection, deep Jewish connection to the land. So they'll have one type of guy who'll be like Arafat, will be like, there has been no Jewish documentation in this land for the last 10,000 years. That's an Arab line, right?
Right.
But then another person will be like, oh, of course there is. But you guys are always undermining the digs of the Muslim periods.
And this is classic like law school strategy.
In the alternative, right?
You just give it anything you can. You throw all the arguments at the wall, as they say.
Right.
And you see what sticks. And whatever sticks, that's the argument
right.
You go with.
But that's not exactly it. I'm actually saying that it's more than that. It's that actually they have a station for every type of person. They have an answer to weaken you for whatever position you're coming from. If you're like on the whole spectrum. So even on the right wing spectrum, they have answers to you. Not on the real right, they'll say to you, you're a racist and you're a supremacist. Oh, that's another thing.
That's not the left.
No, that's for people like the
oh,
right.
People on them.
Yeah. By the way,
like Jews on
them. Very interesting thing. Nationalism is supremacism in their innovative new language. Yet at the same time, they want a Palestine, right?
Which is their nationalism.
Right. But like they have completely. Then whenever they speak to you, it's like, oh, you mean you have
no,
a right
because
to this
the,
land?
The new strategy, Shai, is that they don't want a nationalism.
Right.
You need to know that the new strategy is away from two-state, not for everybody, but the newest effort, like
right.
they're testing the waters with this one,
right,
is that they don't actually, they're actually ready to give up on the idea of exclusively Palestinian nationalism. They have an identity. It is Palestinian. That is nationalism. But they don't necessarily need to run a state. They'll just do something together with us. We'll just run a state and
right.
and we'll just kind of see how that works out. And if it happens to be that 10 million more Arabs move in and make that into an Arab state, oh, look at that. Oh, I guess that was the democratic choice,
right?
You know, that everybody made. And that's not nationalism, even though now it's nationalism. And, you know, there's like a Taliban type Hamas thing running it. That's not nationalism, because we started this thing from a secular,
right? That's liberal that's my democracy. Point. My point is that it's like endless tricks. It's like
it'll right, and be that's what it is, and that's what you tried to prove, and I think you did a good job with that last night. Is that you tried to prove that the idea of running Israel as a secular liberal democracy for all people, no matter who you are, Jews, non-Jews, is really a tactic to make Israel not a secular liberal democracy for all people.
That's right. That's right. And that's what Yocheved, who's on my team, told me that I sort of even said it even clearer. Mm-hmm. I should have said that even clearer, which is like, this is a tactic to create a situation like we have in Afghanistan. It's not a takeover of fundamentalist totalitarian Islam, what I like to call totalitarian political Islam. And that's another word for jihadist. By the way, I'm constantly searching for the right word for bad guys, right? So I came up a long time ago with the word jihadist to talk about
those people.
But you know, my Arab friends from the UAE, they don't like that word.
Why?
So much, because they're like, no, jihad is a sacred, important Islamic value.
They see it as like a more spiritual thing. I've heard that before.
Do you know what
that it's really like a personal quest right. for like spiritual upward mobility to try to purify yourself.
Do you know what word they really like when you want to talk about the bad guys? Palestinian.
Really?
Yeah. They're like, Palestinian.
Use that.
Yeah. They're the bad guys. You know that. They're them. They're the bad guys. Those guys, they're bad.
You cannot. Yeah, it's tough out there.
It's tricky out there. Listen, Malka, today's show is brought to all of us by the Israel Bible. And when I say the Israel Bible, I mean the Israel Bible because it's brought to you by God. But I also mean proper name, the Israel Bible.
TM.
T, right, exactly. You say TM and then you hear a from heaven. But the Israel Bible, redacted by my good friend and a mentor, Rabbi Tuli Weiss, has an incredible product that came out. It's a Bible that's with Koren, the great publisher, and it's a Tanakh that everybody has to have in their house. People have sent me pictures of their Israel Bible in their house.
Do they love it?
Everybody loves it because it's a beautiful cover, a beautiful book,
font, very aesthetic.
Beautiful English, beautiful translation, and a commentary on the land of Israel's centrality throughout the Tanakh. It's just
right. It's very
a
rich.
Product.
It's very rich looking.
You know what I mean? It's just well done, yes. And it's rich and spiritually rich.
Right.
Check out the Israel Bible. Go crazy, and when you get to the coupon code part, type in Yishai.
Yeah, what do you get?
You get 10% off,
yes.
And you get a thumbs up from God. Okay.
Yes, now that's great.
That's right. The other folks I want to thank for the show are Yocheved Seidman, Moshe Herman, Ben Bresky, Tabitha, and Lou, who, although I went live and I didn't hear him today. I didn't see him on the live. We're going to have a great show. We already have a great show with Malka Fleischer, but we are going to have more great stuff. We have Eugene Kantorovich talking about his new PragerU video about do Jews have rights in the West Bank? And I also have Rav Mike Foyer talking about the Torah portion of the Ten Commandments, the Yitro. So that's a lot of people that I want to thank. And I also want to thank the Hebron Fund for keeping Hebron strong. And I want everybody to check out the hebronfund.org. Very proud to be associated with the Jewish community of Hebron and the Hebron Fund. And jewishpress.com, putting out great stuff. Including the Yishai Fleischer show and a great weekly email. Somebody just asked me, so a friend of mine just asked me and said, my friend David, the chef, said to me, is there a website that is going to explain the Sheikh Jarrah evacuation from a normal perspective? Mm-hmm. So I said to him, jewishpress.com and jns.org. Those are the two best news sources out there explaining, and of course IsraelNationalNews.com, that's Arutz Sheva, and I owe them so much because they were the ones that first gave us a job and first started the show, so let's thank them.
Credit is due.
Absolutely. And actually one more thing, which is that this week I'm going to have an article appearing in Makor Rishon, which is the Israeli Wall Street Journal, if you will, and I'm very excited to have an article, of op-ed piece appearing there. That's going to be seen by a lot of folks, and I'm excited about that. And I also want to thank, of course, Prohibition Pickle. Oh, if only Yuchaim would come to my door this Friday to help me pass this Shabbos and help my taste buds get back to health. through some salami, and I will take out the vodka.
They say that you should take vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc,
salami, quercetin, and vodka.
Yeah, and salami
and vodka. Okay. Yeah. I also want to thank you, Malka Fleischer, for being with me here. I appreciate you very much. And I want to wish you a refuah shlema.
Thank you very much.
Beshar kol cholei Israel v'kol cholei ohavei Israel.
Yes, very okay? Nice, very nice.
For all the people in Israel who are sick and lovers of Israel sick. Because that's what the show is about. The show is for Israel and for lovers of Israel. Okay.
And you're out there. We know you. We see you.
We do know you're out there. We love you so much. And we do send you our love to wherever cold and funky place you're at, or hot place, wherever you are in this world. There's so many good people out there. I wish I could name every single one of you, but I'm just mamash sending you the good juice and the good energy. Prohibition Pickle is found on Facebook and on their Instagram, Prohibition Pickle. Prohibition Pickle. Check out also my debate with Amir Zahir at Sulcha. It's a YouTube page, Sulcha, S-U-L-H-A.
Very good.
And Zeo, let's get to my discussion with Eugene Kantorovich about Jewish rights to Judea, and my discussion with Rav Mike Foyer about Mamlechet Kohanim, Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests, or a kingdom of ministers, and a holy convocation. Stay tuned for that, Maka. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
All right, folks, you are listening to The Shai Fleischer Show. We haven't been live on the social media, Facebook and video stuff for a while, but we're back. We're back in black, and everything is great. And it's so great to be broadcasting from Judea to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. But we say that, I say that line every time, that we're broadcasting from Judea, and yet one could say that we have no rights in Judea. We shouldn't be in Judea. And the Jewish people are thieves of the West Bank. And a great video just came out. I want to make sure that I could play it for you properly. A great video just came out by Prager University, by somebody who is a friend, but also somebody that I respect a lot. And I want to make sure that you guys see it with me. So let's go see this incredible video from PragerU with Professor Eugene Kantorovich.
How many times have you heard that Israel occupies the West Bank? Probably more times than you can count. But have you ever asked yourself whether it's true or even what it means? Let's do so now in the most objective way possible. That is, in the way that all territorial questions everywhere else in the world are resolved. To do this, we must look at the law. But first, we need a little history. Up until 100 years ago, the areas now called Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, and all the countries around them were part of the Ottoman Empire, which ruled over a vast area and many peoples. Neither the Jews nor those Arabs we now call Palestinians had a state, though the Jews had a nationalist movement calling for one. Everything changed after World War I. The Ottomans fought on the losing side with Germany. By the end of the war in 1918, their empire had disintegrated, leaving the British and French in control of much of its territory. In earlier times, the victors would likely have kept this land as colonies for themselves, but there was a new spirit of democracy in the air. The Allies, including the British, French, and Americans, agreed that the former Ottoman lands should be allowed to become independent nation-states. After the war, the nations of the world created the League of Nations, a precursor to the United Nations. Meeting in San Remo, Italy in 1920, they set up what was known as the Mandate System. The colonies of the defeated powers, Germany and the Ottoman Empire, were converted into distinct geopolitical entities, which became the countries now known as Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. None of this is controversial. There was one other mandate issued, the mandate for Palestine. Now, Palestine was merely a geographic label, the name the Romans gave the Jewish kingdom of Judea after they conquered it. There was nothing exclusively Arab about it. The mandate provided that Palestine would become a national home for the Jewish people. There was a simple reason for this. The League recognized that Jews were the indigenous people of the area. All the mandatory territories in the Middle East transitioned to statehood in the 1930s and 40s, with Israel the last to do so, declaring independence in May 1948. Now we get to the legal stuff. What were the borders of the State of Israel when it declared independence? International law has a simple and universally applicable rule for determining borders of new countries. It's called the Iuti Possidetis Juris Principle. Lawyers love Latin phrases. The rule provides that when a new country is created, its borders match the borders of the previous geopolitical entity in that territory. For example, the borders of Ukraine, Latvia, and Azerbaijan are exactly what they were when they were parts of the Soviet Union. Other considerations, such as demographics, are not taken into account, because without a simple, easily applied rule, a new country's borders would never be settled. A recipe for permanent conflict. Applying this rule to Israel means that it had sovereign claims to all of Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, and Gaza, because those were its borders according to the Mandate of Palestine. To be sure, the United Nations proposed a resolution in 1947 with different borders and a much smaller area for a Jewish state. But that resolution was a non-binding recommendation, nothing more. It did not have the force of law. We know what happened next. Upon declaring independence, Israel was immediately invaded by five Arab armies seeking to destroy it. Israel survived, but Jordan managed to seize parts of Jerusalem, as well as Judea and Samaria, which it dubbed the West Bank. All the Jews living in these areas were expelled, or to use the contemporary term, ethnically cleansed. Here, we need to introduce another key principle of international law. A war of aggression cannot be used to change another country's borders. Israel and Jordan signed an armistice agreement in 1949, an agreement to temporarily stop fighting. This truce had no legal effect on borders. When Israel liberated these territories in 1967 during the Six-Day War, it was retaking its own land. You can't occupy land that belongs to you. So where are we now? In 1994, the Palestinian Authority was established as part of the Oslo Accords. Israel didn't have to agree to this, but it did. While not being a sovereign state, the PA operates independently of Israel. The PA, not Israel, governs the lives of Palestinians living in the West Bank. Israel has offered the Palestinians a fully independent state on several occasions. Each time, the Palestinians have rejected the offer, something no other national independence movement in modern times has done. Whether or not it makes sense for Israel to renew such offers is an open question, but it's under no legal obligation to do so. I'm Eugene Kantorovich, professor of law at George Mason University, for Prager University.
All right.
Thank you for watching this video.
All right, hold on.
To keep PragerU videos free,
that.
Please consider.
And that was wonderful. Thank you very much, Eugene. That was just fabulous. And we have Eugene Kantorovich, Professor Eugene Kantorovich, with us right now, who is a professor of law at George Mason, Mason University, and also the director of the International Law Department at Kohelet Policy Forum. Eugene, thanks so much for being with us. And that was a fabulous, and everybody could tell that that's just a fabulous video that lays out the history. There's a lot of complexities there. There's a lot of history that people don't quite understand. People just know kind of, they think, the UN said that there should be an Israel and a Palestine. That's basically like 1947, 48 is what people know. This video lays it out. So first thing, tell me about the creation of this video. Where did that idea come from and how has it been received?
So the video has been long in coming because the wonderful people at Prager University had thought that there was a need for a short film of the kind they make, laying out the legal issues behind Israel's borders. Amazing thing about the Prager University people is they're highly, highly professional filmmakers. Like they're in LA and they really, the gentleman who runs it, Alan Estrin, he used to make Hollywood movies before he started educating the world and used his talents for even greater good. But they're still very professional about their filmmaking. So it's all filmed in a studio, very high production values. So we had to, since I am in Israel much of the time, we had to find a time I was going to be in the United States, and then COVID started, and travel was suspended. So I thought we would do it by Zoom. Everyone was doing everything by Zoom, but the Prager people said no. We're never going to do Zoom. We're going to make films, and edit them professionally. So then it was like another year before I got out there, and it was well worth it because they make amazing films.
There's a lot of facts within this 5 minute presentation. What do you think is the most missing in the average student's minds out there when they're fighting the battle of being told that Jews don't have rights to the so-called West Bank or what we would call Judea? What do you think is kind of a key factoid in there that like everybody's got to drill down and remember when they finish watching the film?
I think the West Bank was part of, you know, I think part of the problem is names. Israel, Palestine, what do all these things mean? Israel used to be Palestine. That makes it quite confusing. And now the Palestinians say, well, we're Palestine. Israel used to be Palestine. It's a big mess. What people need to understand is the rule that establishes the borders of countries around the world, the standard default one-size-fits-all rule for establishing international borders, makes clear that upon the establishment of the state of Israel, all of the area of mandatory Palestine, Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria were within those borders. And if you don't have a question about Jordan's borders, so one thing we have to mention, students never have a question, does Jordan have a right to exist? What about Jordan's borders? Aren't they arbitrary? It has that weird arm, Winston's hiccup sticking into Iraq. Why do they have these borders? The answer is exactly the same. It comes from the mandate for Palestine. Jordan was part of the mandate for Palestine. It also inherits the borders of that irrelevant section of mandatory Palestine. So I think that's one major fact. The basic rule of international. I think another thing people get confused in is, and it's in fact, I think it's the fault of Israel in many ways. Because Israel was so happy to have any kind of international legitimacy, international recognition. Mm-hmm. It started acting as if international recognition was legitimacy was a prerequisite for its existence. And so Abba Eben talked about UN, the UN partition plan as being Israel's birth certificate. Now, I've been to the population registry of countries. They don't keep their birth certificates on file, right? Countries don't have birth certificates. Countries are created, and they do not need a vote of the UN. So I think Israel, by being so happy that there was this UN vote, gave it more legitimacy than it actually had legally.
Right. The 1917 Balfour Declaration was very important. The 1920 San Remo Accords was very important. The League of Nations mandate in 1923 was very important. But the partition plan all the way at the United Nations, that did not have the force of law, nor was it that important. And basically, it was actually reneging. Some people say that the partition plan itself was kind of an illegal move, reneging on already agreed upon law that the League of Nations decided of the borders of the mandate. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I don't think it's illegal because it has no legal force. It's like thin air. So had it purported to have legal effect, it would have been in contravention of the mandate. But they knew the mandate. They knew they couldn't change the terms of the mandate. They knew they could not take away the land of Israel from the Jewish people, which is why they didn't say that they're actually partitioning anything. You know, people think of the 1947 partition resolution as actually saying we're splitting. They didn't say we're splitting. They said, Britain, maybe you should think about this kind of split. We think it would be a good idea. They didn't split because they knew they didn't have the authority. So it was not even legally binding enough to be illegal.
So over celebrating it, the partition plan has been one of the.
It's natural that it was celebrated at the time.
Right.
But my father calls this the happiness of the poor Jew. That, you know, when the pogromniks just break the windows and don't kill anyone, because the UN was really considering two versions of going back on the League of Nations mandate. They were thinking of either just saying forget it, no Jewish state, or maybe a little bit of a Bantustan ghettoized Jewish state without Jerusalem. And since those were the two options on the table, they picked the less terrible of those two options to recommend. And they did not even stand up for that. That is to say, when the Arab states came to say, no, we're going to go to war to ensure option number one, no Jewish state, the UN didn't say, no, you're going against our resolution. We're going to fight you. In effect, they lent their practical support to option number one, by not allowing the Jews to defend themselves. But the notion that this was somehow the celebration of this has created this impression that it was had a legal effect, which it didn't.
Right.
Supposed to have. The Jews in 1947 were delighted because they thought it would have a diplomatic effect. That is to say, that it would deter the Arab countries from invading, which it did not have. There's an amazing State Department cable, a CIA cable to the State Department, actually, from 1947 that was revealed a while ago. I think it summarizes everything in the Middle East ever since. The CIA was recommending that the State Department oppose the UN partition plan, that they favor just an Arab state. Because they said, if there's partition, if the UN recommends a Jewish state, the neighboring Arab countries won't invade. Because how could they go against a UN General Assembly resolution? They'll never do it. It would just be embarrassing for them. However, the Arabs in Palestine will still conduct guerrilla war against the Jews, and that will be enough to wipe out the Jews. So then we'll all have to feel bad again. So they were wrong on every single part, right? Mm-hmm. The Arabs in Palestine didn't wipe out the Jews. The Arab countries did invade. It was completely wrong. But that's State Department Middle East analysis. But the idea was that this would prevent war. That's why the Jews were happy about it.
So PragerU puts out great videos. And I know we have some mutual friends whose whole understanding of things has shifted about so many issues. Even myself, our mutual friend sent me some videos about nuclear energy and its efficacy and safety, et cetera, from PragerU. And I was like, those are really good arguments, because what they do is they have top people explaining things really, very well. And so too, now you've explained Jewish rights in Judea and Samaria, or to Judea and Samaria, and also to other places like Gaza. At the same time, towards the end of the video, it's the trickier part where you say, look, where are we now? Israel helped establish a Palestinian authority which rules this place. And once you do that, you can understand why somebody would understand, well, you believe that these other peoples are the rightful owners of this land, and you're not claiming rightful ownership. So just like before, when you were talking about the over-celebration of the partition plan, so too, when you take narrative steps, when you take steps to give somebody else, empower them in this piece of land, it's really hard to walk that back, to claim that you have the right to own it. And we're in this like middle zone where there's an element of Israel which claims ownership, and then there's an element of Israel which claims it should be a two-state solution. So how do we expect a student or somebody else to understand things well?
So I don't know that. So we're in a middle place, in a sense, because Israel's a democracy, because Israel's a Talmudic country. There's lots of opinions. And so, what the truth, but what's the actual rule? It's hard to understand. But those are political questions. Those are political questions. Those are questions about what should be done. It's certainly true that Israel is not good at narratively asserting its rights. The Palestinian position is powerful because, while wrong, it is often repeated and very clear. It's all ours, it's all ours, it's all ours, it's all ours. The Israelis often want to seem
sophisticated. It's not Talmudic. It's not Talmudic.
Israelis want to seem sophisticated, and they often think that nuanced arguments will show to people their goodwill or sincerity. But it's definitely the case that Israeli governments are less vigorous than they should in clearly stating Israel's legal case. That is partly because Israel is not actually ruled by its government. It's it's a whole separate issue. But one of the strange things about Israel is that professional bureaucrats, in particular, government legal advisors, are a ruling class of their own, and they have views about this that are not always in accord with the government. But Israel, the legal point is very clear. You don't need to like make a speech every day saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine, whatever, like the Palestinians do, to preserve your legal rights. You know, a country is created, they don't need to make speeches every day about why every piece of their territory belongs to them. But certainly Israel does many things to make it confusing. And I think greater clarity about the role of the Palestinian Authority would be helpful. But at the same time, it's hard to blame the Israeli government too much. Because if they were to say things more clearly, there'd be like an immediate diplomatic assault. So they're trying to avoid that. It's probably short-term thinking. But there's many things that create this narrative problem. I think one that we've been talking about recently is when you look at Judea and Samaria, the Jews live in gated, ghettoized enclaves. And move around from little island to island, and the Arab population, Palestinian population, has the run of the land. They're not fenced in, they're not gated in. And when you think about South Africa, apartheid South Africa, with the blacks gated into Bantustans, and the whites can go wherever they want, you think, whose country does it look like it is? So that's another issue. Again, this was done for security reasons, but it has a narrative effect.
Right. Interestingly enough, yesterday I debated a Palestinian activist by the name of Amr Zahar. So he kept saying that, you know, you want to put us in Bantustans, you want to put us in reservations. And I reversed it on him and I said, actually, we're the reservation in the great Arab landmass. We're this, you know, 20,000 kilometer small New Jersey sized thing that is trying to assert its laws and defend its peoplehood and defend its nationality within your broader area. We're the ones that are in this small thing trying to defend ourselves. And I think that was a surprising to him a little bit to reverse that. He was trying to say that we're creating an apartheid state. And I'm saying we're actually a small reservation trying to keep ourselves safe.
And I think it's a very important point that there is in fact apartheid policies here. I think it's impossible to say that there's not apartheid policies in Judea and Samaria, but those apartheid policies are the policies of the Palestinian Authority, which does not allow Arabs to sell land to Jews. That's apartheid. So Bantustan, come to think, I want to take it back. It's not a Bantustan, because Bantustan is when you have like a group that is locked into little ghettos in a country. But the Palestinian Authority makes it quite clear they don't want Bantustans. They want there to be no Jews in their territory. They want to complete. Bantustan would be a step up from what the Palestinian Authority wants.
Right. No, and they have managed to ethnically cleanse, wherever the Palestinian Authority has full control, it has managed to ethnically cleanse Jews from there, from the Tomb of Joseph, from many parts of Hebron, but still the Jews hold on pretty strong to a small enclave in Hebron.
Whatever areas are under Palestinian rule are entirely Jew-free.
Right. That's right.
With the exception of Amir Ahas. Like with one. Minus
with the exception of what?
Amir Ahas.
Amir Ahas, that's right. I want to say that people out there are very happy with your video at PragerU. Moshe Novick writes, that people cannot occupy their own indigenous land, which is something you say. My friend Louis says, Dr. Eugene Kontorevich, you are the best. It's an excellent video. I've been following you a long time. Thank you. Thankful for PragerU and you. And then Pearl asks, why don't campuses allow this history to be given to students, which is really...
That's why it's called PragerU. PragerU is supposed to design to go straight to the student, because fighting for inclusion on the in the syllabi of legacy academic institutions is not useful. Watching PragerU, better education.
All right, Eugene Kontorevich, I want to thank you so much for being with us. You're a professor at George Mason University. You're also the director of the International Law Department at Qohelet. And you've got a fabulous new video at PragerU, which is entitled, Does Israel Occupy the West Bank? Which is one of the questions of our time and one of the modes of attack that call for... That are a mode of delegitimizing Jewish rights in all of Israel by saying that we're foreigners in a place that used to be called Judea, now being replaced by the term West Bank. If we're foreigners there, then we're foreigners in the whole place. And that's really what's behind this, right? It's not really a fight over the ownership of the West Bank. It's really to delegitimize Israel in toto. Would you agree with that analysis?
Yeah, that's good. We see this already because there's a narrative that says, why should we focus on the West Bank? Let's strengthen the Negev and the Galil. And then the Jewish National Fund goes to plant some trees in the Negev, settlers, or some Jews go to live in Yafa or Lod. Lod, where I was learning Daf Yomi, all the yeshivas were in Lod. The Jews go to Lod, settlers. You're settlers here, you're settlers in the Negev. So settlers means Jews coming anywhere, it seems. So it's focused on one place because it seems where the international community will give more backing to the efforts for a Judenrein area, but it's impossible for anyone to pretend that the intention is limited to that.
Eugene Kantorovich, thank you very much, and may we be strong. Thank you for giving a lot of people strength, and it's going to take a few times for people to watch. People who are not schooled in this information, it'll take them a few times to watch this video and understand it, break it down, and get those points in their head. And if you don't have time to understand and be able to argue that, you got the simple point, which is legally speaking, Jews have every right to Judea. Sometimes the law makes sense in the end.
That's why it's only 5 minutes, so you can watch it a few times.
That's right. Eugene Kantorovich, thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Toda rabah. All right, folks, we keep going here, and we have with us Rabbi Mike Foyer. That's right, we're going to keep going live. Rev Mike, shalom.
Woo, I'm coming live. I'm feeling that live energy. You just brought me in on the beat that I don't think I've ever felt before. Plus, I'm sure my background is going to drive you nuts because it's not centered like you usually make
it. Don't worry about it.
Let it all go today. We start with a little bit of backstory. Hi, Isha. It's been too long.
It's been too long, and we just did now what I've never done before, which is like move the guest after a guest on the live TV broadcast.
That's why I gave you the cheer coming in. I knew you needed the encouragement.
That was really exciting. That was a really exciting thing, and I have to admit something now, which is that I had Corona this week.
Refor Shlema, right.
I had Corona, but not the big Corona, the little Corona, not the big devil, the little devil. I had, Omicron or whatever it's called.
Omicron. Savior of us all.
Seemingly.
The bringer of the endemic instead of the pandemic.
It was still a weird sickness. And the reason I say this is just because it just does weird things with your head a tad. And all week long, I've been studying the Parsha of next week. I was like doing mishpatim all week.
I thought you were like speaking to the conspiracy theorists among us who don't believe Corona is such a thing. That was your confession that you had it.
No.
You're saying you're confessing that you didn't prepare the Parsha.
I did, but the wrong Parsha. I was like working on mishpatim and thinking about it. And then this morning I'm like, isn't it Yitro the Shabbos? Isn't it?
Could be worse. Right, you could be arguing with the Baal Korah, saying, you're in the wrong place.
Right. Figuring it out late. That's right. Rev Mike Foyer, creator of the Jewish Story podcast and many more good things here on the Land of Israel Network. It is the Torah portion of Yitro, which is, for me, recently, when I say the word Yitro, more and more I have things to do with Druze, the Druze contingent here in Israel. In fact, recently, I was at Caliber 3 anti-terror training school, and the two guys that were training me in gun shooting were two Druze. That I have had that situation where there was one Israeli and one Druze guy, but to have two Druze instructors,
it was surprising. Percentage of the population, it's surprising, but there are warrior people who have quite a long tradition that predates their partnership with us. So it doesn't surprise me. We're accepting the statistics. I mean, there aren't that many Druze in the country.
But you said it very well just now, which is there are warrior people, and you could feel that when you're being trained. You could feel that.
Yeah.
I like that. You know what I mean? I like that. There was a Worf.
That's the Russian in you.
Yeah, there was a Star Trek Worf type of thing going on there. There was like a warrior thing going on. I really like that. And the training that he brought to us was very visceral. It felt very like ad combat. It was very good. Now, one of the things, now this guy has a beard and he looks really Jewish and he speaks a perfect Hebrew. I mean, you would have to be really good to pick it up that he has a different language and a different home than a Jewish home.
You could barely pick it up. The second guy, you could pick it up easily, but this one, not. Which is neither good nor bad. I'm not saying that that's a value. Yeah. I'm just saying it happens to be.
It's just a statement of what you're experiencing.
Right. He was very, very Israelified. We joked together when it was time for a minion. He said, you know, only if you need a minion, can you count me? I can be the 10th guy and things like that. And then he said, look, you guys believe that Moses received the Torah at Sinai, and who came to Sinai to meet Moses? His father-in-law, Jethro. That's our prophet.
Yep.
And he said it very, how should I say, like, right?
Matter-of-factly.
Right. When
matter of factly, yeah.
Right. You may not get that in America, you know, like that. But here it's like, you guys received the Torah at Sinai and Jethro came. That's us.
That's us, right. And there's the a long lineage there. Right. You know, I mean, the children of Jethro follow us right down through even and out and into exile. You know, so it's not a small thing. And the Jews have been holding out in this land who knows how long. I mean, I'm not so familiar with their own internal story. But I do know they live on the hilltops. Not out of choice for the view, but because they've been resisting invaders for longer than most can remember.
Right. That's right. So that's this week's Parsha. That's like their Parsha. So let's say L'chaim and God bless the Druze. By the way, the Druze have not always been pro-Israel. Sometimes they aren't, sometimes they aren't. It's well known that the Golan Druze, sometimes for a long time, the ones that live in Israel sided with the Syrian side of the conflict.
As it's been explained to me, it's principle, if not of the religion, then at least of the culture, to sort of side with obvious power, right? Like they support the Malchut, you know, if we're going to use like the Jewish terms for it, right? They support the Malchut. That's what they do. They're a minority warrior people, as opposed to, like, you know, the Jews, by the way, have played the same game in most places that we exist in exile. It's a very powerful strategy for a cohesive minority people in majority cultures to support the Malchut. Now the challenge, of course, is what you're pointing out, Megalon. It's when the Malchut is in doubt, you end up in sticky situations. So hence the fact that Israel took until 1980, if I'm not mistaken, to formally annex the Golan. And there are still many claims against it. So the former President Trump crossed, you know, lines as far as, many Americans were concerned in recognizing our sovereignty over the Golan, you know. So it's hard to blame the Druze for the confusion there. Someday when we really have Malchut Yisrael.
That's right.
You know, it will be clear, hopefully, to them how clear they cited their ancestors were, so to speak.
Right. Well, what you're really saying is, and what Eugene Kantorovich just before you said, which is, to be a Middle East country, you have to speak with clarity and you have to assert your assertions. You have to assert them. You have to say, okay, this is my land. This is my sovereignty, and this is how I rule it. And you can accept it or not accept it, but this is the way it is around here. And people respect that, and that's part of the language of the Middle East, the language of respect.
Yeah. Listen, whether they respect it or not, it's for darn sure. If you don't do that, you'll get nowhere at best. Mm-hmm. Meaning, like, you know, I think that for the Jews to demand respect around here, it's going to take more than clarity of speech. Although you're correct, it's got to start there. But meaning. Right. We ain't getting anywhere without it.
Right. That's right. Yehuda Shamroth, our good friend, says, I thought you were going to say you finally had time to prepare the Parsha.
Because you were in Corona. No, wait, what you may not know, Yehuda, is that he comes prepared every week with like a list of questions and structure. You try nothing. I've never had you. I mean, this is like, that was the confession part, which people may not appreciate there, is that I always come to be along for the ride. I mean, I happen to learn the Parsha along with every other Jew out there, right? But it's a different thing to come prepared to like discuss it.
That's right. The other thing is also what Yehudas is discounting, maybe forgetting the way it used to be, Yehudas, is that remember that if I'm in Corona, that means all the kids are home.
Yes.
And the kids are home means no productivity.
There's not so much going on other than them.
Yeah, other than that. We did watch our favorite American show, called Forged in Fire, okay, which is about blade making. It was really, really fun. My gosh. Huh? It's an American show called Forged in Fire.
That's funny because America, relative to the rest of the world, has such a short tradition of making blades. I think it'd be like Japanese or something. I don't know.
They're good. They're good.
Oh, no, Americans are good at any material.
They're good at that stuff.
The tradition. Right. Yeah, let's talk about the Parsha, actually.
Okay, well, what Johan says, Shalom Rabbi Yishai and Rav Mike Foyer. And Lewis says, looking good, Mike. Okay.
Thanks, Lewis. Feeling good.
You're doing really good. Okay. We're not going to be able to go through the whole Parsha. This is another major one. Every year when we get to parshas like this, I think to myself, I understand the tradition that used to be that you would finish the Torah every 3 years. I think that if I lived in that time and then they came around saying, let's do it in 1 year, I'd be like, no, let's do it in 3 years. That's good. 3 years and then have a big old party every 3 years. That's good.
Yeah, but we got Simchas Torah out of it. So, you know, it's not all bad.
Yeah, but parshas like this, there's just so much going on. We're talking about the Torah portion that is famous for being one of the two sets of Ten Commandments or two retellings of the Ten Commandments. But I want to talk for a second about the few phrases right before the telling of the Ten Commandments, okay?
Critical ones that they are.
Right. On the third month, B'chodesh HaShlishi, let's say B'nei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim, the third month after the Jewish people had left Egypt, B'yom HaZeh Ba'u Midbar Sinai. And this very day they came to Mount Sinai. Now there are tachanot, there are stations for the Jewish people. One is, the first station was of the Exodus, was the splitting of the Red Sea. That's the, mm-hmm. the you know what, or depends how you count it. One way you could say is the real first station is the sacrifice of the sacrifice Corbin of the Pesach. Paschal lamb and putting the blood on the doorsteps. That could be understood as is one. You're still in Egypt, but you're already free. While you're already in Egypt, you're already a free man inside, right? Mm-hmm. Two was the splitting of the Red Sea. Jewish people become a nation.
Born out into the wilderness.
Wait, but let's talk about the splitting of the Red Sea.
That's the image. They become a nation, like literally the birth canal.
Right, the birth canal. You are also imbued with prophecy, like everybody's going to have a psychedelic moment.
Well, right? It's a parallel to Sinai, you know, because there's also a law giving that comes right afterwards, if you're going to count that in your Tachanot.
Right,
meaning
well,
when they come out to Marah.
Ah, right. Right. Okay.
And sham lo chok umishpat. Right. That's why Rashi says that there God gives both chok and mishpat, like the sort of ineffable divine command, and like the justice system aspect of law. Got, you know, Shabbos, some other things.
And then the big stop at Mount Sinai. That's when there's going to be one of the greatest moments between mankind and humanity. Excuse me.
And in that parallel, God, by the way, and mankind. Works the same way. There's Ma'amad Har Sinai, fire, lightning, mountain in flames. And then there's Mishpatim, there's the giving of the law. And the same way has happened with Kriyat Yom Suf and the splitting of the sea, you like said, that spiritual psychedelic moment, to borrow your phrase, right? And then at Mara, Sham Sam L'Chok U'Mishpat, like you're here now, do something with that. Otherwise, right? For those of us who've seen those doors of perception open, know that it can be for naught if nothing comes of it.
I think you're making a very important point, which is a central facet to Judaism. The ecstatic moment is not the end-all be-all. It's got to come back down with stuff.
Not only is it not the end-all be-all, it's only the means too, really.
Would you agree with me that sometimes in Christianity, there's the sense that like the love moment, the big moment, the revelatory moment is enough? And kind of stops right there without coming down and bringing down a very...
I don't know Christianity from the inside well enough to know if that's true. I can say that historically and structurally what Christianity did was strip away the law and the emphasis on embodied prophetic, like historic embodiment of prophetic vision. So on that level, absolutely, that's like what Christianity is as opposed to Judaism. And in practice, I don't know, because like I said, I don't really know it from the inside. But in the end of the day, when we speak of ourselves as a people of law, it's not in the sort of Pharisaic, casuistic, you know, like quasi-anti-Semitic sense that we've been painted by Western society. It's in the sense that embodied life in history and in daily life is the greatest expression of the divine. That is. The ecstatic moment by stepping outside, maybe getting to some higher plane and what happened at Sinai and mi yodeh ma yeh b'olam haba. I don't know, right? Yoshvim ziv shechina, the righteous will sit in glory in the glory of God's face. Who I don't know, but the expression of God in our world is in law and action,
right? Right,
that's the world we live in,
right?
Right, and so therefore, it's not just it has to come down with something. That is the purpose.
And it makes it makes the revelation of God, which is what a prophetic, ecstatic moment, psychedelic moment is.
Oh, it can be, because those can also just be
blown can be
of the capacity to hold what you're looking at, and like, you know, it doesn't have to be divine per se.
But I'm talking about when a person knows that they felt in their life a divine
moment.
Yeah,
it can be.
But then it keeps it so much more modest, so much more hidden, so much more like that moment was a moment of clarity, and it was a marching order. It's like you're a submarine and you went up to periscope depth to get the message. You got the message, you go back down, to stealth, and then you got your marching orders and you got to go, you know?
Have you ever looked at the amount of plutonium it takes to create the explosions that you see pictures of?
It's like this?
Yeah, I mean, Google it sometime.
Yeah.
And you'll get an expression without compare, I think, of what you're saying, which is that it's not just that it's like underground. It's that that energy has now become matter, so to speak. It's in there still. Mm-hmm. It's in there. It's actually what it is. But in order to be able to do something with it, it's the container. Right? And then our life is constantly attempting to release that energy that's in there.
Right.
Like, I mean, and to continue the metaphor one more step, halavai, right? Oh, that it were that we had really the capacity to unlock the potential that the Torah and our consciousness really could bring to the world right now. That's what we're hurting most, in my humble opinion, with all respect to your guys' earlier conversation, which I caught the end of and I agreed with, that a settler, I wrote you in the chat, I don't know if you saw it, that what I understood from what it was, that a settler amounts to the fact that Jews don't belong wherever they are, which, by the way, means really anywhere at this point. So like being, that, not just in Israel, by the by, you know, American Jewry has been tasting that lately as well, you know, and certainly European Jewry has known it for a long time, right? But the place where we're really hurting is our inability to unlock what the Torah has.
Well, let's get to that actually, because that there you go right there. The what you're talking about is going to be one of the most challenging verses for Jewish people, which is okay. Vata. And now we're talking about the book of Exodus, Shmot, chapter 19, Yutet, verse Hey. Vata. And now. If you hearken to my voice, ushmartem et briti, and keep my covenant, ve'item li sgula mikol amim, you're going to be a special, a treasured nation, a powerful nation, an able nation from all the other nations. Ki li kol ha'aretz, for to me is the whole land. And so here's the chosen people phrase. And this is,
well, careful, don't make that leap. I mean, you're correct conceptually, perhaps, but be faithful to the language of the Torah. Am Nivchar comes elsewhere. This is mm-hmm. This is segula,
right?
And I think you did quite well. I would contest maybe powerful, contest, but it's not entirely.
I use powerful because the of the word others, mesugal.
Yeah, well, that's why you said able afterwards, right, which I thought was more accurate, right? You know, but treasured, you know, precious. That yeah, it implies chosen. I'm not.
Fine. No, then you're right.
But I think the precision there is important for this context.
These are the words, though, that some of the Jews have a hard time with. They have a hard time saying.
Well, some Jews. Other Jews, like, eat, breathe, and live this. That's like what it is to be a Jew. Bepashtus, as we say. In simplicity, that's just what it is. Like, I mean, you can try to say it's something else, or you can legitimately make an argument that it's been many things, but, like, if you get rid of this, on some level, you got no Jew left, eventually, if not in the immediate. You understand? That we've always been something else. It's one of the reasons that we're also struggling so much in our national embodiment, right? Like you know, that Zionist illusion of secular Zionism, that the world's opposition to us would disappear once we had a national re-embodiment, right? The classic, you know, Pinsker's, you know, the Jews, like the ghost, the Judeophobia that haunts, you know? It was a complete mistake and misunderstanding of what the Jew is. And yes, true. Right. The boundary is more now with us as a national, as opposed to this Jew or that Jew. But essentially, we're always swimming upstream. That's what God just said.
Right. Right.
Definitionally. It happened at Sinai and Zeo.
Yeah, like
you can leave the team, but you can't get out of that.
You can't get out of anti-Semitism, but you can push it back now. You can fight.
No, I'm not talking about anti-Semitism. I'm talking you can't get out of the
school. I'm talking on the Pinsker level. On the Pinsker level.
Yeah, but Pinsker also noticed, like, Pinsker had one deep root in the assimilationist movement, as did many of the early secular Zionist or pre-Zionist. He's technically, I would call him, you know, the herald of like last, but you know, because they were problem solving oriented. The problem of the Jews was that they were suffering in Europe, and the myth of modernity was what if the Jew just checks his culture at the door and becomes like the rest of us, he's welcome to join. And we saw how that ended in modernity, you know. It's still playing itself out in certain ways, but
it's playing itself out.
Classic modernity didn't end well.
I think that the secular Zionists had a very important historical role, and that is to help us, as you say a lot of times, re-embody.
It's problem solving. It's not a bad attitude.
It's not just problem solving. It's also a trait that had been bred out, which is the characteristic trait of action. And they were the breeding, and you needed a pure breed. And they were pure breed action. They did
not understand then in through your translation of Skula why Rav Kook, right? One of the great rabbinic minds of the 20th century, getting it out of the mystic, etc. Why he almost alone amongst his rabbinic contemporaries of that scale looked to the secular Zionists as part of the redemptive process is because how you translated the word segula. He looked at them and he said, they are able.
Right.
And not able in the crass, pragmatic sense of they'll be able to do it, but in the sense that like, whoa, I'm watching these guys drain the swamps and move from like Russian intellectuals to Mediterranean farmers and like, that, like he's like, they are able. They're so, you know, like they, like I'm skulazo, right. You know?
That's the voice of Jacob, but now the hands are also the hands of Esau, of Esav.
We just don't want to lose that voice because the hands are always seductive.
Let's just finish up. So now that you're that kind of nation, the next phase is v'atem tiyuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. You'll be to me.
I mean, now I would be careful because you did so well with segula. Take your time. Well,
mamlechet kohanim, kingdom of priests.
Okay.
And a holy nation.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to push a little on priests. I mean, you obviously,
let's call it.
Give me three words for segula:
servants, civil servants.
Nice, because Rashi goes with
ministers. Is that the word? Ministers.
I actually think in English the most accurate term is minister, because it works both in the political sense, like Rashi brings about B'nai David, that they him kihinu, right? Like they, you serve, you know, even today in modern Hebrew. You say that he served in that, you know, he was a minister
capacity, right?
In that capacity, right? And also, I think in English, it bears also the religious aspect of the priesthood, which is a ministry, right? It's not, you know, like I just think that it sounds strange. You trust me, it doesn't work with the average American to translate that as a kingdom of ministers and a holy nation, but
a kingdom of bureaucrats,
or either that or like, you know, they picture like, you know, in the ministry, like, but nonetheless. It's important because in calling all of Am Yisrael Kohanim, in this context, God is illuminating so much of the book of Vayikra, right? What's the Kohen? The Kohen stands between the people and God, so to speak, but he faces both directions. When he's facing God, he's on behalf of the people. When he's facing the people, he's on behalf of God. Am Yisrael is meant to serve the same purpose between God and creation, or at least humanity. Let's not blow ourselves too out of proportion, right? But like, at least humanity that we speak to, right? We face the people on behalf of God. We face God on behalf of the world. So it's that fact that our particularity is always in service of the universal, because that's why it ends.
That's right.
Because I'm concerned with the whole world. You're my ministers.
And I think that also God is saying, I need a channel in this world. I need to be able to channel. I need to be able to channel things in this world, channel of knowledge, channel of love, channel of prayer, a channel of ideas. I've been listening recently to one of the great rabbis of our time, Rabbi Stephen Przanski, and he has got a series on the American Jewish influence on America. And
oh yeah, I should listen to that. I bet it's good.
It's phenomenal. And you know, I've been shocked. Because I've been like, oh my God, I cannot even believe the level of which impact the American Jewry has had on what we understand and know of as this thing called America.
Oh, yes.
And it's just, but in every field and in everything, it's just like the impacts are, it's like the thing that you think you know is America is so much influenced by a Jewish thing. To me, that's like, okay, when God wants something done, he sends in his channels, and his channels develop stuff, and his channels send stuff. It's an energy. It's a knowledge. It's an aggressiveness. As Mark Twain called it, the aggressive mind of the Jew, you know,
the aggressive mind. We do have a little bit of an aggressive
mind. Yeah, it's an aggressive mind. It's aggressive well, mind. And
that brings us back to what follows this. Like you pointed out, our aggressive mind is meant to be devoted to the Torah.
That's right. It's meant to be right? a channel of the Torah. That's right.
Well, yeah, but meaning otherwise we can get a little off the rails. I don't know if you've noticed historically that as you point out, sometimes it's off the rails for the good. And of Prasansky's point about how much, you know, that Jewish aggressive mind brought to American culture, and for sure in the Jewish story, I've seen it very clearly. Oh, my focus is a little bit different. But it goes off the rails too. I mean,
oh yeah.
Listen, Marx, Freud, Einstein. That's all I have to say to you.
That's right. These guys changed the language of the world of the 20th century.
All right. The Tov and the Mutav, as we say.
That's right. That's right. Okay, Rev Mike Foyer, time is up. I want to thank you so much. People can reach out to you for your spiritual counseling and for your other show. They can do it at revmike.com. Is that correct?
That's the best place. Everything's there.
Okay. And people can check out also jewishstory.co.
That's right.
And your other great show, and your spiritual counseling as well, which is one-on-one and personal and highly needed for a lot of people. And thank you so much for sharing Torah with us.
I'm going to say goodbye.
All right, folks, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rav Mike Foyer and with Eugene Kantorovich, Professor Eugene Kantorovich. Malka Fleischer, thanks for coming back on the show.
Yes.
I just want to wish you a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you for being such an awesome rock star. And yes, I want to wish you a refuah shlema.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. You too and everybody else out there.
Yeah.
I thank God I keep a lot of chicken in the freezer, you know?
Yeah, you keep a lot of
those weeks.
Is that like a metaphor? Keep a lot of chicken in the freezer? Is that like some
That's not like a Southern saying, no.
It's not like a Southern Jewish thing?
No.
Got a lot of chicken in that freezer. You know, no, okay. I don't know. I missed the South. Yeah. Hope to get back
down
there soon.
You still have your boots.
I sure do.
You should have worn them out in the snow.
No, they're actually by design formal boots.
Ah.
They're not like
dress up boots. They're for your, you know.
They're for your fancies. They're for
fancy.
They're for your hoedown. What is wrong?
I don't know.
Why do you keep laughing?
I don't know.
I don't know. Okay.
Whenever you try to be a Southerner, it makes me laugh.
I missed the South. I want to say hi to my good friend Ann, who listens to the show. I want to thank Krista again for supporting
all
the
that
show.
Coffee.
For all that coffee. That's go to buymeacoffee.com/Yishai. I want to thank the Land of Israel Network as well. Ari and Jeremy doing such a great job. It was great to host both of them last week on my various media, including the show. And I want to thank Hashem, God Almighty, for giving us a chance to just be a small part of your great vision. Thank you, Hashem. Help us get through this funky time and get to greener pastures, but all in the meanwhile to do your work to help push propel this world forward in your way, in your direction, and B'ezrat Hashem to teach your Torah and to send it out to the world in the way that you want to through Kiddush Hashem, and never chas v'chalila through chilul Hashem. And thank you, Hashem, for all the strength and for every ounce of life that you've given us, the greatest gift to do your will in this world. God bless you, folks. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Write me an email, yishai@yishaifleischer.com. Lots of love and shalom.
Shalom.
Zionism, political and secular, says Ben-Gurion, held that Israel must be redeemed by its own efforts and by natural agency, that the Jewish people on its own must create the foundations of a new life. While I'm definitely looking to found a new life for my people in the land, although I'm not so sure we can do it on our own, because I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is The Jewish Story.
Join Rav Mike Foyer for the best Jewish history podcast, The Jewish Story, on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.